It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, there's been a big jump in the rates of sexually transmitted diseases in the United States. We'll talk to a Wisconsin doctor about the problem and possible solutions. First, the Wisconsin Veterans Home in King has been under a lot of scrutiny after staff, volunteers, and residents made public allegations of neglect and improper care. Starting this week, state auditors have been interviewing staff, including a whistleblower, about the claims. Meanwhile, apparently unrelated to that story, it was announced that the state's Veterans Affairs Secretary would be resigning. Joining us now to talk about all of this is Caitlin Farrell. She's the public affairs and investigative reporter for the Capital Times. Caitlin, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, take us through the basics again of the story. You reported on this. What were the allegations that, as I said, volunteers, staff, residents, families made against the Veterans Home in King?
Sure. So I had talked with several current employees, former employees, and then some residents and family members of residents there who had just spoke of troubling conditions regarding the facilities there that had been aging and outdated, some issues with medical errors, and a variety of healthcare issues that they said had stemmed from prolonged staffing shortages and CNAs and nurses there who were overburdened. That was pretty much the bulk of it. There are also issues, too, with how the home had been making money from the federal government and how funds had been transferred from the home to other homes.
What was the response from people like state legislators and others after your story came out?
Sure. So shortly after my story came out, there had been calls. I mean, Senator Luther Olson, who was just reelected, had also gotten several complaints from constituents, and so had former Senator Julie Lassa. And so the Legislative Audit Committee had met in September, and at that meeting, lawmakers from both parties unanimously approved an audit of the home. And so that means that the nonpartisan Legislative Audit Bureau went in, that they are now in there, conducting a 6 to 9 month audit of the facility.
Yeah, so that audit is going on now, and as I understand it, auditors are talking to employees at the facility now a couple times a week.
Right, yep. So they sent out an email to employees earlier this week, I believe, just telling folks that they are going to be physically on campus for 2 weeks. It's Monday through Thursday, November 7th through the 10th, and then next week, November 14th through the 17th, just encouraging people to come and meet with them in person with any concerns they might have. They've also pretty widely circulated, the Legislative Audit Bureau has a fraud, waste, and mismanagement hotline, and so callers to the hotline can remain anonymous. And there's also, I think, an email where folks can send documentation of any complaints or concerns they might have. And so there's a variety of ways that this nonpartisan bureau that works, at the direction of lawmakers are trying to get information about what's going on there.
And you're right, there's also an investigation going on of an employee there who had shared information with authorities, basically, about this being investigated as a personnel issue by the facility. What's going on there?
Right. Things are a little bit unclear at this point. I know that the employee I had spoken with did meet just about an hour ago, actually, with some HR representatives at King, and it's unclear at this point what might happen from that meeting. I know that employee, does have an attorney and is working with the attorney, but it's unclear, what now might happen. But yes, that state employee is being investigated, and my understanding is that's still ongoing. So I'll continue to follow that, and if that employee is terminated and what the fallout of that is, I'll continue to report on that. So,
and this is someone who would at least informally maybe be considered a whistleblower, though I don't know if they would be under the technical meaning of that when it comes to the law.
Right. And I'm not, frankly, so sure about that at this point either. I mean, my understanding is that this employee, has sought counsel from, lawmakers and spoke with a variety of levels of management before eventually coming to me. This was one of many sources and people who I spoke to for the story who corroborated, what this state employee was saying. And so it's not like everything that I had written was sort of based on one account, but the person is still there, obviously, and so that's always a risk for them.
Talking to Caitlin Farrell from the Capital Times, she's been following the story at the state's veterans facility at King. And what has been the response from leaders of the facility itself, the state's Department of Veteran Affairs, since your reporting? Have they contested what you've written about and what people have said there? Have they worked to improve things?
Yes, and so generally, Secretary Skokas and officials there have largely disputed some of the concerns that I had raised from employees and residents in my reporting. They point to some the federal rankings that are given to them. So the state, on behalf of the federal government, goes in and does inspections of the nursing home, just like every nursing home in the state. And King has gotten consistently high rankings from that. And so, one thing that I will continue to do some reporting on. I plan to have a story, hopefully, on this in the coming weeks. Is just that disconnect, because it's something that I don't really quite understand, and I think a lot of people who have firsthand knowledge about what they've seen at King don't really understand. We've seen some federal reports come out with several instances of medication errors. The facility did receive a report where there was an immediate jeopardy, which meant that a resident's life was in danger. And I don't believe, actually, that those surveys were included in the composite score that gave the facility a 5-star ranking in its most recent report. Anyway, those are outstanding questions that I'll continue to report on. But largely, the agency has maintained that the home is of a very high quality. Secretary Skokas has said that the food there is wonderful, that the water is clean, and they have pointed largely to how federal regulators have rated them. So,
in other veterans-related news, news about Secretary Skokas himself, he's now the outgoing Veterans Affairs Secretary. He announced he would be resigning. It was announced he'd be resigning. Do we have an indication of why he's leaving the post?
Not officially. I have not been able to really get, I guess, a specific reason. As I reported in my story last night, Governor Scott Walker's spokesman, Tom Edenson, had said that Skokas is seeking to pursue other opportunities, but he would not specify on what those were. And so, I have spoken to a few folks in the veterans community just on background who think it's a bit curious that he is choosing to leave in the midst of an audit as this is going on, although the audit is going to take 6 to 9 months. And, the governor's office had said to me that they are sure that his departure is not going to affect how that audit is conducted or what the results are. But I think the timing is curious for some folks in the veterans community. But no official distinct reason that I have right at this point.
And any indication of the process for replacing him?
No, I did ask the governor's office that as well. And, they just said to me that they have quite a bit of time at this point. He's not leaving until January 7th. So they have several weeks to get that together. And there was no names or folks that they could give me that they might be considering at this point. So,
Caitlin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Caitlin Farrell is the public affairs and investigative reporter for the Capital Times. She joined us to talk about investigations into allegations of substandard treatment at the Wisconsin Veterans Home in King, as well as the announcement that the state Veterans Affairs Secretary would be resigning, effective January, as we just heard. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recently announced that cases of sexually transmitted disease are at an unprecedented high in the United States. Last year saw a big increase. According to that CDC report, the rise comes at a time when local STD programs have experienced budget cuts, leading to the closure of over 20 health department clinics in 1 year alone. Dr. Kristen Sharp joins us now. She's an OBGYN with UW Health. Dr. Sharp, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So what kinds of sexually transmitted diseases did we see this big jump in the most recent data? This is looking at 2015.
Yeah, the reports point to chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis all seeing a significant increase. And with STD reporting, those are the main ones that are mandated reporting. So things such as herpes or HPV or trichomonas are not mandated reported. So we don't have kind of up-to-date information about the increases in that.
Why do you think we're seeing this jump, the substantial jump in 2015?
Yeah, I mean, I would have to agree with what the CDC report stated, is that we're seeing a lot of closures of STD clinics or other health providers that especially provide health care to lower income men and women. Because, you know, with this increase, I think in general there's two causes. There's education and then there's care. And with closures and budget cuts to these programs, both the education as well as the direct physician-to-patient care is suffering.
These are curable diseases, the ones you mentioned, syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, I believe all treatable with antibiotics. Is it maybe that people are starting to think these are nuisance diseases, I can take a pill, get over them, and not worry so much? I mean, are we getting blasé about these diseases?
Yeah, I mean, I would have to say from the patients that I've seen, especially with these diseases, I haven't seen that sentiment. But I think what is happening is these are easily transmissible, and then these are asymptomatic or often asymptomatic infections. So someone can go about their life for days, weeks, months, even years, and not know that they have this. And so, you know, with other sexual encounters and partners, they could be easily spreading this from person to person. But you're right in that these are easily treatable diseases. So thankfully, when someone is diagnosed, we can treat them. But until that they know they have them, this can be spread widely.
Right. And if somebody isn't diagnosed quickly, I mean, these are diseases that can have very serious consequences.
Absolutely.
They?
Absolutely. For both gonorrhea and chlamydia, it can lead to an infection called, in women, pelvic inflammatory disease, which can lead to infertility. It can lead to chronic pain. And syphilis is even more scary. People can get severe health issues with syphilis. We're talking about organ failure. In its final stages, people can have dementia. Actually, for a little historical factoid, Al Capone had syphilis and ultimately died from it. And again, easily treatable disease. And with syphilis as well, this can be passed congenitally onto infants. And so babies can be born with lifelong problems due to a syphilis infection.
And with antibiotic treatable diseases, there are often antibiotic resistant strains. Is this something that is happening with any of these diseases?
I don't have accurate data about that. We are starting to see across the board some strains of multiple infections that can have some antibiotic resistance. But the CDC has not changed any of their treatment guidelines, and we're actually not currently screening these bacteria for resistance because overall that rate is still quite low.
So for screening, for a sexually active person in particular, how often do you recommend they get screened for these sexually transmitted diseases?
Yeah, so for sexually active people, especially in the highest risk groups, which tend to be people in their teens and their 20s, we recommend at least yearly screening. But if they have any changes in partners, we recommend getting rescreened with any change in a sexual partner.
And as far as birth control goes, I've read anecdotal suggestions anyway in reporting that suggests that some people think I'm on birth control, the pill, some other form of ongoing birth control. So that's all I need to worry about as long as I don't get pregnant. Are you seeing people ignoring, say, a condom as a anti-sexually transmitted disease option?
Yes, absolutely. I've seen this with my patients time and time again, where a lot of the focus goes on the contraceptive piece, but not in the disease spreading piece of keeping one's health safe. So that's something I'm constantly reiterating time and time again, that, you know, even though you have an IUD or you have, you know, the birth control on board, you can still get an STD. So consistent and correct condom use is important. And I think this all points to kind of the education component piece of this as well, as people need to understand what's going to protect them and what's not going to protect them and how to accurately use barrier methods of contraception, such as a condom.
Talking to Dr. Kristen Sharp. She's an OBGYN with UW Health, talking about increased transmission of sexually transmitted diseases. High numbers in the most recent data, 2015. Big increase in certain populations. Can you talk a little bit more, Dr. Sharp, about who should be particularly worried about this, both in terms of who's most at risk and who's most endangered if they get one of these conditions?
Right, and I think the people that are most at risk are the people that could have potentially the most most harm done. So consistently, you know, throughout the country, most STDs occur in young people, the age group of 15 to 24. So these are going to be the ones at highest risk. And then, for example, with gonorrhea or chlamydia, if you have a young woman, for example, who gets a severe infection, she may have fertility issues down the road. She may have, you know, lifelong chronic pelvic pain from these infections. Other groups that are high risk are homosexual couples. So men who have sex with men are also at a high risk for these diseases. And we've noticed a significant uptick in STD rates among this population as well.
Did HIV, when we as a country started finally paying serious attention to it and treating it, did our efforts against HIV help for a while with these other sexually transmitted diseases?
Yeah, I think so. Because we know that the best method of preventing STD in a sexually active person is with barrier contraception. So a lot of kind of health education and resources went to really promoting safe sex health practices such as consistent condom use. So as a result, a lot of these other STDs were also protected against.
And do you think we're not paying as close attention to HIV? It certainly hasn't gone away as a problem, but it's not the epidemic it once was, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, it got a lot of hype in, you know, the late 80s and the early 90s. It was, you saw it everywhere. It was constantly talked about on the news and in magazines. And there's definitely not the same attention that it got then. It's still out there. People, I think, still are relatively knowledgeable about that, but certainly there's been a lack of attention pointed towards that.
In terms of public health infrastructure, you mentioned a decline in the availability of clinics in some cases. What would you like to see? What do we need out there in terms of access to screening, testing, to contraception, and at barrier methods, as you mentioned, that we don't have now?
Right. I mean, I think one is just availability, wide availability of clinics and clinics that are either free or affordable to people who have lower resources. As well, I think education goes into that too. And so that's, you know, trying to educate people even before they become sexually active about how do you prevent transmission of these diseases. If you are concerned or you need to get testing, where do you go? Because I see a lot of women who just don't even know where to go to get testing from. So having that information widely available and having accurate information online, too, it's really scary. The information I find online sometimes that is spreads a lot of myths about safe sex and STD prevention.
Unlike a lot of health conditions, the issue of STDs comes with moral dimensions, with political dimensions. Do you see among your patients maybe a reluctance to seek contraception or screening or treatment because of moral issues associated with sexuality?
Yes, I have. I think it's been a barrier for seeking care. I think it's been a barrier for people talking about this and trying to get more information. Despite the kind of scientific knowledge that we have about STDs and safe sex practices, it still continues to be a barrier.
And then education in schools. This is another, I'm sure you know, long-running argument.
Absolutely.
In this country. And that's ended up with an incredible patchwork. What one school does might be radically different from another school, between states, between districts, within districts.
Right.
Are there certain basics that you really wish could be in every school's sex ed program?
Yeah, I mean, I think just knowledge of what are these STDs, what is safe sex, you know, what are different methods of both barrier contraception as well as other forms of contraception. And, you know, I know historically there's been a big push for some abstinence-only education, which abstinence is absolutely important and it's absolutely a method of preventing disease and preventing pregnancy. But for a lot of people, when they make the decision to become sexually active, they need to have that education and then the tools and the knowledge of where to go or who to talk to make sure that they're keeping themselves safe.
You mentioned clinics available to people with low income. Probably that would include, I imagine, Planned Parenthood clinics. I don't want to put you on a political spot here, but has a decline of Planned Parenthood clinics been part of the decline in access to these STD prevention screenings and education?
I would say absolutely. A lot of the services, actually the majority of services that Planned Parenthood provides is STD education and prevention, as well as cancer screening, such as for cervical cancer and doing pap smears. So with the decline of availability of clinics to provide these resources, we're going to, I fear, continue to see a rise in this.
With this news, this report out from the CDC, looking at, I mean, alarming, I think it's a pretty big increase in some sexually transmitted diseases. Are you seeing people take this as a wake-up call to try to get more education, screening, treatment out there?
I think for a medical community, absolutely. I think we need to continue to also promote this amongst patients and say, you know, this is a big problem. They're seeing the highest number of STDs they've ever seen before since they've begun collecting this information. So hopefully this can be a wake-up call for people to say, okay, what do I need to do? What do I need to tell my children? How do we kind of promote this message of how to stay safe and how to get screened? Because again, if you don't have symptoms of these things, you may not know that you have these until you get screened. And by that point, there may be some serious consequences from this infection.
Dr. Sharp, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Kristen Sharp, an OBGYN at UW Health, talking about why rates of sexually transmitted disease have been on the rise, a big jump in CDC data out last year, or from last year, just out recently, talking about possible solutions to that as well. In the United States, it's estimated that over 5 million caregivers care for veterans wounded in the line of duty. Many of these are the wives of veterans who, without much training, are thrust into roles wherein they have to grapple with traumatic injuries. And many of these women take up the roles willingly, without any guarantee that things will get better, often with little support. According to our next guest, many of these women tackle this head-on and grow more resilient through times of frustration and joy. Joining us now is Barbara K. McNally, author of Wounded Warrior, Wounded Wife, Not Just Surviving but Thriving. Barbara, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you, Rob, for having me on.
Well, you started with your work with veterans' families in a fairly dramatic way. Can you tell us the story of the man on the bridge?
Yes, the impetus for me writing the book was I was driving across the Coronado Bridge and I saw a man jump to his death. And I thought of his wife, mom, and family, and curious, I did a little digging and found out he was a wounded warrior who felt he didn't have any other options. And working with the wives of wounded warriors, this was my impetus to turn such a horrific death into something positive.
So what did you find out when you started talking to wives of veterans, of wounded veterans?
Well, actually, I have a background in physical therapy over 20 years, and I've been running a support group for the wives of wounded warriors for the last 8 years. But it wasn't until I witnessed this death that I decided to actually write a book for women who couldn't come to this support group and to offer hope and tools through the book for anyone all over the U.S. who's caring for somebody who comes home from war with visible and invisible wounds.
So what kind of things are these women you work with dealing with? What are some of the common stories that they tell you?
Well, all of them are blindsided. We never expect tragedy in our life. And also, all of them have been wounded, too. Think of, if somebody you love is hurt, it's going to affect your life, too, and hurt you, too. So these women are not expecting tragedy. They couldn't live expecting their husbands to come home wounded. Of course, they're in the military, but none of us expect tragedy, and none of us are really prepared for them to come home with invisible wounds such as post-traumatic stress or the visible wounds with amputations, brain injuries, and so on. So, and all these women, we have over 5 million caregivers, and of those, 20% are younger than 30. So these women are truly not prepared to care for our wounded warriors. So I really want to give them support so that they can help not only themselves adjust to this new normal, but their husbands too.
want to talk about some of the stories you share. The wounds we're talking about are sometimes visible, sometimes invisible, sometimes both. And sometimes there's a change in personality, maybe due to psychological trauma, maybe due to head injuries. Talk about Julie, the wife of a veteran named Jason.
Well, he came home, and yes, he was, his post-traumatic stress went more as a depression. He refused to leave the house and really was giving up on life. And everybody heals differently, and everybody, they're individually, may express post-traumatic stress differently. And also, just to back up, for post-traumatic stress, it's a normal reaction to a trauma, and war is trauma. So it is normal for somebody to come home and have some stress. So he was going through a lot, and she, because that's how, why I'm helping the nurturers nurture their husbands, is because they know more than anyone what tools will work. And he used to love to fly fish, and that was one way she got him out of the house, was through Project Healing Waters. And together they went fly fishing, and that got him that first step out of the depression, to get out and find out. Once he was with Project Healing Waters, he found out he wasn't the only one going through this, bonding with other wounded warriors, and that was the first step to healing. It's always getting out of that isolation.
Talking to Barbara McNally, her new book is called Wounded Warrior, Wounded Wife, Not Just Surviving, But Thriving. And Barbara, when we talk about caregivers, we've talked a lot on the show about adult caregivers, maybe for aging parents, people like that. And one thing I hear again and again is the need for the caregiver to make sure they're giving care to themselves as well. Are the women in this position taking care of their wounded veteran spouse? Are they able to care for themselves as much as they need?
Well, that's why I started this program. I call it Spa Day, Support, Purpose, and Appreciation. And that's why I wrote the book, too, to give them the resources they need to keep care of themselves. And now there are some programs out there. The great thing I found out about researching and working with these women for the last 8 years is there are some great programs out there. And not everybody works with every program, but for anyone out there who's a caregiver, to buy this book, or if you know someone who's a caregiver, give the book to somebody, and they'll find that specific resource and tool that helps them care for themselves. Because you're right, we need to nurture our nurturers. And this is Veterans Day, and I want to honor our veterans, but I also want to honor the hidden heroes, the silent strength behind our wounded warriors, who are helping them heal. So it's very important that, yes, we keep care of ourselves so that we can keep care of someone else. So I really want to support our nurturers.
You've worked, as you mentioned, with support groups. And I imagine, like a lot of problems people might have, a lot of people in the day-to-day, they think they're alone. They're going through this on their own, them and their spouse in this case. How important is it for them, the caregivers, to get together and share their stories and realize they're not alone? They're going through this with other people.
Right. Well, Mary Angela says there's no greater angst than having an untold story and holding it inside. So one of the things is either through the book, there's a way in the back where women can get together and tell their stories. But Spa Day's a time where they can get together and tell their story so they realize they're not alone and they can learn from each other, because that's, all of us have wounds, invisible wounds, and some of us physical wounds. And just knowing we're not alone is the first step. And also, I like to give the example of, you know, the flight attendant. You know, before takeoff, put the oxygen mask on yourself before helping somebody else. So in order for these women to care for their wounded warriors, they need to learn healthy self-care. They need to take time to nurture themselves so that they can keep up with the stamina. Many women say, you know, I'm so busy being the anchor for my family, I'm drowning myself. And we want these women to get the support they need.
How about a message for people who know people in this situation, friends and family members? What can they do in a positive way to let the veteran themselves, the caregiver, know that they're supported and actually support them?
Well, the first investment is probably the book, because maybe you'll find an organization in there that you're really excited about. Like there's Vail skiing or horseback riding, fly fishing. There's lots of organizations out there for veterans and their wives. And so maybe, you know, we always say, oh, we want the VA to do more, but as citizens, we can do a lot too. And all these are philanthropy groups that are out there. That was the most positive thing I found in working with the Wives of Wounded Warriors and researching, is there are good programs out there. I would love, you know, if you're wanting to help nurture the nurturer, you can help my foundation, the Barbara McNally Foundation. But maybe you have another cause. We can always help in our own backyard, wherever we are. I'm sure there's some really good programs that are nationwide. For example, Project Healing Waters is in Wisconsin, too. And so is there's so many in the book. But there's lots of programs that we can all participate in to help heal our wounded warriors and their families.
You wrote a piece, I think you had it up on BuzzFeed, about some myths about families with wounded veterans in them. And one of them was that, oh, well, of course, they don't need much help. The community pulling together for them, no problem. When you make cases in the book where actually sometimes friends and family are shying away, maybe because they don't know what to do. In one case, a couple is uninvited to the party because there's kids, there's other people with family in the military. They don't want them to see a veteran who's been injured in battle. What can we do to give that community care on that really personal level to make sure we're treating them well, not formally, just on a day-to-day basis?
Right, and I can't give one answer for every wounded warrior, but the first is make eye contact, notice their humanity, and ask what you can do, because everybody's individual. The story in my book about uninvited was a military family was having a Christmas party, and one of the men was going off to war, so they asked the family that had a husband with double amputee, please don't come to the party, because we don't want our kids to see that this could happen to their dad, which is just a painful reality, you know. So I would just encourage everybody, you know, we don't know what other people are going through, just like back to the suicide on the bridge. I also have a whole chapter on suicide prevention, and not only military, even though that's been in the media, the 22 suicides a day. But how do we stop that? It's by noticing somebody's humanity, because we don't know what somebody else is going through. So just giving them eye contact, asking how their day is going, that's a good start, really noticing each other, because we don't know the invisible wounds that people have walking around us.
We're talking to Barbara McNally right now about her new book, Wounded Warrior, Wounded Wife, Not Just Surviving but Thriving. It's about how spouses of wounded veterans provide care and find hope and strength. We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? Are you caring for a wounded veteran, a spouse, a loved one, a parent, a child? What have you learned? What are the challenges? What has helped you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234. If you are a wounded veteran yourself and want to give a shout out to someone who's cared for you, or let us know what kind of help would help you, call in 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about the challenges and triumphs of spouses of wounded veterans who ultimately become their caregiver. We want to hear from you. Are you a military wife or husband? Do you serve as a caregiver for a wounded spouse, or maybe a child or parent? What questions do you have about process? What advice could you need? What advice would you share if you are a wounded veteran yourself? What kind of care, what kind of help do you get from a loved one? If you want to talk about the role they play, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Barbara McNally stays with us. She's the author of the book Wounded Warrior, Wounded Wife, Not Just Surviving but Thriving. Barbara, another myth on that article I had seen. A lot of people think, healthcare, that's all paid for. There's ample financial support from the government, from the military. Reality, not necessarily.
Yes, and especially in the transition phase, you know, from active duty to being discharged, often there's a lag time in getting your payment from the VA. So, that's a crucial time where families need a lot of support, not only income-wise, but, you know, how are they going to redefine their life after being in the military for so many years and plus a physical injury? So, yeah, that's the VA, as you know, can get a bad rap, but it's better than it was 8 years ago, and we can always fill in with support groups and other things, like just really reaching out and asking how we can help. Another, you asked how to help thank the wife on Veterans Day. Sometimes it's nice, you know, when you see a veteran say, can I buy you a cup of coffee? And maybe his wife's pushing him in a wheelchair behind and say, hey, thank you for your service too. Can I buy you a cup of coffee? Maybe it's just a small start, but it makes them feel like, wow, you noticed what I'm going through too. You've noticed my life's changed too.
And another myth you had talked about is the idea that, well, these are military wives. They're super tough, so they'll get through it okay. And you'd say, well, yeah, they are super tough, but that isn't necessarily enough.
Yeah, I think none of us can do it alone. Back to the suicide on the bridge, you know, we can relate it to, we're all on that hero's journey crossing the bridge, and we either get the resources we need or we jump off. And all of us need resources, and these women especially need resources and support because their lives have changed drastically too. That's why I say where there's a wounded warrior, there's a wounded wife, because her life has changed too. And we want to keep these marriages together if possible, because they are saving our health care billions and billions of dollars by caring for the wounded warrior, for one. And we want to not only thank them, but help them in every way we can so that they're able to, as I mentioned earlier, these injuries are in their 20s, and they will be caring for their wounded warrior not just for weeks or months, but for decades as they both age into their 70s and beyond.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kathy is with us in McHenry, Illinois. Kathy, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say thank you for the program. I've experienced, I did not get any support from the military because at that time they didn't have anything up at the military facility we were going to. And so I had to find this out on my own, and it's right. It does change everyone's lives that it affects. And he has since passed away of a disease. And but I'm so glad that you have this resource book, and that you also have places where women can go and help each other as well as the injured party. And because it's awfully hard to go it alone, because it affects you the rest of your life.
Kathy, thank you so much for sharing that. Sorry for the tough story and for your loss as well. Barbara.
Thank you, Kathy, for sharing. You're absolutely right. That's why I started the program 8 years ago. After 9/11, we were not prepared as a nation for so many men to come home injured. And the good news is more are surviving war, but the bad news is we weren't prepared to care for them, and we had no support system for the wives. So I started this program 8 years ago. Since then, the good news is there are more programs, and I want to give a shout out to Operation Family Caregivers, which is the Rosalind Carter Institute, has a counseling for wives, and that's nationwide. And also I want to give a shout out to Hearts of Valor, which has weekend getaways for women. So now I feel like my role is connecting women with the right support group, and through the book they can do that because everybody can't come to San Diego for a spa day. But the book is national, and one day, maybe, Kathy, you'd like to help me. I want to have these spa day all over the United States, but that's going to take a lot more time and energy and money that I'm just beginning to get. So there is a way to pay it forward, and I'm really sorry that, and I feel you and I hear you. There were not support groups 8 years ago, and the good news is there are now.
Kathy, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Barbara McNally, author of Wounded Warrior, Wounded Wife, Not Just Surviving, But Thriving. Back to our callers now with Jane and Kiwani. Jane, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm an Army retiree, and I've spent the last 9 years being a county veteran service officer. I'm also a wounded warrior, but at the same time, your county veteran service officer, we're paid by our county, and our job is to help navigate the VA, yell at the VA, do whatever is necessary to help our servicemen and women get through whatever they're going through.
Jane, thank you so much. So what kind of things do you help a wounded veteran with and their family, for that matter?
Well, if a veteran walks into our office or a service member getting ready to transition, we can get them hooked up with the VA health care. We can help them with the paperwork to get home adaptation, like ramps put on the house and all that other kind of stuff that they may need. We know where their mental health providers are that are being locally paid for if the VA can't provide services to them right away. We help them get hooked up with their education benefits, their compensation. We know how to file the claims right the first time through. And if there's a financial hardship, we know who to call to get that file pulled from the bottom of the stack to the top of the stack.
Jane, thanks for your service and for the work you're doing now. Barbara, the county veteran service officer, helping with the transition.
Thank you so much, Jane, for mentioning. And, yeah, I do give a shout-out to the VA. I know they get a bad rap, but you're a great resource, and we just want to help you. That's any philanthropies that are out there. We just want to help the VA and any veteran services that are already existing. Thank you.
And Jane, with that county agency, thanks for your call. Will with us now in Madison. Will, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Yeah, so I just wanted to, first off, thank you for having the show and thank your guest for her efforts. But I wanted to mention an organization called Team Red, White, and Blue. It's a nationwide organization that's divided up into different chapters that are locally based and membership-driven. The mission is to enrich veterans' lives through social engagement and physical activity. And it's open to veterans, current service members, spouses, friends, anyone who's interested.
Will, thank you so much for that call. Team Red, White, and Blue. It sounds like there's a lot of groups doing good work out there, Barbara.
Yes, there really is. So I just think sometime what I've heard from the wives is it's overwhelming and it's all noise. You know, they don't know how to navigate, as Jane had said. So it's really nice to hear about these great organizations and help these women find them, because that's the hard part, is actually connecting the women with the organization.
One more quick call. Bernadette is with us in Wauwatosa. Bernadette, just briefly, please. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to mention, too, that there is a Wisconsin organization called Being There, Reaching Out. And it is for families, not just women, but families of fallen veterans.
Of fallen
who have
veterans.
Passed away.
Bernadette, thank you so much. The group is Being There, Reaching Out. That's for fallen service members. Barbara, just in a few moments, a last message for maybe that spouse out there caring for someone right now. A quick message of hope for them.
That you're not alone, and that I'd be happy to, if you email me, BarbaraMcNally.com, I'd be happy to send you a book. So what the feedback I've gotten, it just came out October 15th, is anyone who's read it, who's been a wife of a wounded warrior, has given me the feedback that I can see myself in these stories. You're validating that who I am and the challenges I'm going through, and you've given me hope. So that's what I want to give to you. I want to validate your pain, and I want to help you through that pain.
And Barbara, thank you so much. That's Barbara McNally. More info about her book and her work, Wounded Warrior, Wounded Wife, linked on the Central Time Facebook page. And share your stories while you're there. On this day in 1951, the first long-distance call using an area code was made, making this the 65th anniversary of the three-digit numbers coming into use. The nation was divided into 84 different area codes in 1947, that's a few years earlier, but to make a long-distance call at that point, you had to go through the operator. On November 10th, 1951, the mayor of Englewood, New Jersey, made a direct phone call to the mayor of Alameda, California, by using that area code number. There are more phones now, if you hadn't noticed, than there were back then. There are more area codes, too, from the original 84 to well over 300 now, with room for more growth. I used to be really good at picking out, phone numbers pop up on our screen here when you call in, and I know what part of Wisconsin you're from, and that's still true. But with cell phones now, people are coming in from different states. They keep their old cell phone. And now sometimes new residents of Wisconsin do stump me with their area codes, but I'm even starting to pick those up. Well, stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time.